This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Sloane Crosley about her new essay collection, How Did You Get This Number?
I am surprised by how generous the city can be with you and how odd and quirky it can still be, but I don't expect everything to be laid out for me the same way I probably did when I was 24 or 23.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Deborah Solomon tells us about a new biography of art dealer Leo Castelli.
He got involved with pop art at a time when it had not been officially sanctioned or even shown for the most part. He introduced pop art to the world.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. In these bleak days, living in New York, we sometimes forget how charming and romantic and odd a place it can be. But Sloane Crosley hasn't. She's the author of a new book, How Did You Get This Number? It's reviewed in this week's book review by Maria Rousseau, who says that Crosley is like a tap dancer, lighthearted and showmanlike, but capable of surprising you with reserves of emotion. And she has an original spark. Well, that's nice praise. And Sloane Crosley's here to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First question for you. Sometimes when young authors come in from the podcast, they have a publicist alongside them. Why don't you?
I come with one built in, I think, like a doll.
Explain.
I am a publicist by trade during the day for about a decade now. I've worked in book publishing, both largely at Vintage Books, but also at HarperCollins.
So this collection of essays is really about someone like yourself. You come to New York City from the suburbs. Where are you from?
I am from White Plains, which is the sort of southern region of Westchester County.
You came here when?
Well, I feel like I've always been here. I mean, from sneaking into the city during high school. And then I went to college in Connecticut, so not far off, and moved back here pretty much straight away after graduation. And so that's 2000.
So you write about cell phones and taxi cabs, a lot of taxi cabs. You write about going to a wedding in Alaska. At first, I thought, this will be the longest piece on Alaska I've ever read with no mention of Sarah Palin, but there she is. What is the experience your generation is feeling now at this moment in Manhattan? Is it still bright lights, big city in any way at all?
You know, it's near impossible to speak for the entire generation. But I will say that I think what we're noticing now is just that we do have a generation. I think that age is sort of 21 to, let's say, I don't know, 27, you think that everybody who's young sort of thinks like you. And now I'm 31, and there is a difference between me and a 25-year-old and what I expect, and specifically what I expect of the city. I am surprised by how generous the city can be with you and how odd and quirky it can still be, but I don't expect everything to be laid out for me the same way I probably did when I was 24 or 23.
What about the people you deal with? And because you describe them a lot in the book. Taxi drivers, for instance. How important an experience is that?
It's a vital experience. I mean, that one was really sort of an experimentation in detail and how the more detailed you get about an everyday experience, of course, the more how universal it becomes. But they're pretty vital. I mean, but the truth is with taxi cab drivers is that, they run the gamut just like real people. you can have an amazing experience and you wonder, marvel at how lucky you are to have gotten to this cab and heard this man's amazing story. And sometimes you just want the conversation to end with a really any way you want to go is fine.
What kind of loyalty do you develop to the city? Do you become a New Yorker at a certain point and this is your hometown?
I think it certainly sneaks up on you. I think, having grown up just outside the city, I mean, one of my earliest memories is being 3 or 4 years old, and I remember my grandmother explaining the Chagalls in Lincoln Center to me. It's always been so much a part of who I am. There's, a misconception that a real New Yorker just can't live anywhere else. But I think a real New Yorker is actually choosing to live here. And even if that choice is a steady one, even if they haven't lived somewhere else, the idea that you could move but you're choosing to stay is what makes sort of a New Yorker, I think.
You have some very amusing dialogue in this collection. There's one where you get on the plane to Alaska, sit next to a strange guy. I want you to first tell us about him, and then I have a question for you.
Well, in the beginning of the essay you're referring to, called Light Pollution, I am on a plane headed to Alaska for the first time, and my seatmate is a man named Earl, which is not his real name, we will note for the record. But we start chatting, and he is thoroughly from Alaska, more so than I could ever be thoroughly from anywhere in terms of how he sort of fulfills the stereotypes of Alaska. His mother made gun cases. He was going back to his hometown, which was just outside of Fairbanks, and he told me the story about how he knew this man who he used to buy his chocolate croissants from and his donuts from every morning, who was a baker, who was a big famous murder trial, I guess, in Alaska in the 80s, I believe in the 80s, where he killed a bunch of strippers by luring them into an airplane, taking them to one of Alaska's many sort of obscure private islands, and basically going on a game hunt with them in the middle of the night. And it was terribly gruesome, but told in this fascinatingly offhand way.
How are you able to remember what he said, and how much do you sort of reconstruct?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, that's there's a loophole in that, which is that I was sitting next to this man on an airplane and fascinated in traveling. So you're already a sponge when you're traveling. Meanwhile, you're forced to sit next to one person for about, you know, what is it, 8 hours. So yeah, I remember a lot exactly of what he said. But in general, with dialogue and that conversation included, you usually remember one or two bits clear as a bell where you know, that's why you're telling the story, because you latched onto it to begin with. And then, you know, there are tiny little bits you fill in the rest from your memory of what this person was like. I mean, you don't make it up whole cloth. You say something that sounds like something they might have said, but, you know, You sort of have it be 90% of exactly what you remember. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be telling the story, I assume.
And so you're in a place similar, say, to David Sedaris. There's an acknowledged fictional aspect to what you're doing, or would you not put it quite that way?
I wouldn't put it quite that way. I think everything is true in these essays. It's just not in the order that you would like. I think that there are composite characters where, yes, such and such a thing was said, or such and such a thing was worn by someone, but maybe in a different scenario, 2 weeks apart as opposed to a day apart. A good litmus test for knowing whether or not you're on the up and up is when you warn people that they're in the book. What's funny is people often don't see themselves the way you see them, so the sort of Hirschfeldian swipes you might take at somebody, they don't
go unnoticed by them.
They don't. They never see themselves, and it's actually very bizarre. And I've done that. I won't say which essays, but I've shown people essays. I specifically would like you to read essay X, and they say, "Wow, who is that based on?"
Really?
That's only happened once or twice, and that's super awkward to deal with the fallout of having to, you know, ram that into someone's head.
You then divulge that it's based on that person?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how thrilled, you know, the Riverhead Legal Department would be about this, but my responsibility is the personal relationships I have with these people. I mean, if I'm no longer speaking to them, it's much less of a problem, but in terms of divulging that this is them and this is who they are, that's really their responsibility. I would never embarrass someone by saying, you know, their names or where they work or any sort of salient details about them. Also, honestly, the essay format helps, and I'm sure it helps with David Sedaris or someone like him as well, where you're not writing running with scissors. You know, the common thread, for better or worse, is me.
Thanks a lot, Sloan.
You're welcome.
That's Sloan Crosley, whose new book, How Did You Get This Number, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So we're looking at The New Yorker and its hot list of young or maybe not so young fiction writers. Who's on it? What's going on here?
Well, The New Yorker has, for the first time in 10 years, put out, or 11 years actually, put out a list of its top 20 under 40. And these are the people who aren't necessarily novelists, although some of them have two or three novels under their belts. A couple of them, I think, have a novel right around the corner. But it's a very eclectic list. There are some people who you might expect, like Jonathan Safran Foer or Gary Steingart. But it's a very international list. A lot of people who are not born in this country or whose parents were not born in this country. But this is the people who The New Yorker says we should be reading. It's a snapshot of people under 40 who are producing first-rate fiction in their eyes.
So some of them are short story writers for now, like Wells Tower, who had a very acclaimed collection, would be one. Are they all, Julie, writing in English, whether or not they're American-born or even living in America?
I believe they are. These are people who maybe a generation or two ago wouldn't have been writing in English, but you know, a lot of these people are writing short stories. A lot of them are American, of course, but yes, all of them are writing in English.
And my understanding is that Ferrer, Straus, and Giroux, the literary publisher, will actually produce a volume based on the stories The New Yorker published as part of this big package. You know much about that? Have you heard anything?
Yes. Right after the issue came out this week, FSG announced that they would put together a collection of a lot of the short stories that is going to be published in The New Yorker over the next 3 months or so. And this book will come out in the fall. The New Yorker is going to run in its fiction issue this week. It's a double issue. They've put together 8 stories from 8 of the writers, and then the rest of the stories from the writers who have been chosen will run over the next 12 weeks, one in each issue.
Now, Julie, obviously it must be very exciting to be included on that list, but what if you're a really good writer who's 41 or who for some reason or other was not included on the list? Is that damaging to them in publishing terms, or are they really being evaluated by book publishers? Is there a kind of promotional or marketing aspect to all of this?
I mean, I think you can look at the whole list and say, this is a gimmick, this is a way to sell magazines, lists are silly. But there are a couple of people who I'm sure are lamenting the fact that they're 40 or 41 and didn't make the list last time around, which was in 1999. But I think it has value for a youngish writer who's getting their name out there, who's getting a drawing in The New Yorker, a story in The New Yorker, you know, their little picture. So, and I think it's flattering. I mean, some of the authors I talked to who were on the list said, well, this was great. I'm delighted. I'm honored. I celebrated by not being neurotic for 45 minutes and then went back to being neurotic.
Because in the end, the books still have to get written. The work has to get done. It's not really so much about publicity, even if it does help them a little bit.
Right. It's great to have sold a story to The New Yorker, but in the end, they still have to produce another one and another one after that. And these are people who, according to The New Yorker, are doing excellent work, and it's still very tough out there for fiction writers.
And Julie, do we have any sense with the big fall season coming, the September and October books, when a lot of major fiction is published, that the publishers are hopeful now? Are they still worried about the recession? Any indication of whether things will be improving for them?
Well, a lot of publishers have said over the last few weeks that they're doing better right now than they were a year ago, which isn't saying much because last year it was doomsday. They were in the middle of a recession. They were having great difficulty. So there seems to be a little bit of hope that the recession is easing up a little bit. Things are turning around. A lot of booksellers are saying that their sales are up over last year. So there seems to be a little twinkle of hope.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One book to consider is The Walk by Richard Paul Evans. This is the first book in a new 5-part series from the New York Times bestselling author, telling one man's tale of moving from personal tragedy to triumph. Booklist calls The Walk, quote, a journey worth taking. That's The Walk by Richard Paul Evans, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview. That's audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Leo Castelli was one of the most important arbiters of the art world and fixture in Manhattan for many years, he's now the subject of a new biography. It's called Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli. It's by Annie Cohen Solal, translated by Mark Palazzotti, and reviewed for us by the great Deborah Solomon, who's here to talk about the book. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Did you know Castelli?
I did meet him a few times. I didn't put that in the piece because I feel like every other review is going to begin, I met Leo Castelli a few times, and I didn't feel that my experience of him was particularly unique. But I did interview him several times, and I found him to be charming, as he is known to be, but rather limited in his discussion of art. He liked to talk about paintings he had sold and resold and where they were now, which is a completely legitimate subject for an art dealer, but I didn't find him to be a great philosopher of any sort.
What was his taste like?
Admirably, I think he really embraced new art. And what amazed me as I read this biography is I thought, here was a deracinated European who came to this country, of course, after World War II, and knew about art, and certainly could have made a very good living selling Picassos and Matisses and European paintings. He did do some dealing in the 50s where he helped Sidney Janis sell Kandinsky. And I thought, why didn't he stay with that? He could have led a very decent life selling European masterpieces. And instead, he got involved with pop art at a time when it had not been officially sanctioned or even shown for the most part. He introduced pop art to the world. And in that sense, I think he was a showman. He liked to put on a good show, and the best dealers do.
And who were some of the major figures he represented?
Well, first, he represented the first generation of pop artists, including Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, James Rosenquist, Klaus Oldenburg. Mm. And later on, he went on to show early minimalism.
And who are some of those?
Frank Stella, Carl Andre, Robert Morris. He showed Richard Serra, who's not quite a minimalist, more of a post-minimalist. But you get the idea, a lot of sculpture later on, and he was determined to show things that had not been shown before.
What made Castelli so successful? What did he bring to this profession of art dealing?
Well, there are two possible theories. One is that he was very lucky and opened his gallery in 1959 in time to capitalize on the emergence of pop art.
And where was that gallery?
That gallery was on the Upper East Side on East 77th Street on the top floor of his father-in-law's townhouse.
Mm.
Later, he moved to Soho. Most of us who got to know him knew him during the Soho days, and his gallery was, of course, a regular stopping point for anybody who cared about contemporary art through the 70s and the 80s.
So one theory is he was lucky. What's another theory?
And the other theory is I think that he, don't laugh, was organized. And that was a radical quality for that time because the dealers before him belonged to the bohemian 50s. You had people like Charles Egan previously who showed de Kooning and whose gallery at times was closed on Saturday afternoons because he forgot to open it. If you needed a transparency and called the Egan Gallery, he would have laughed. Castelli, who had been a banker in Europe, ran the gallery very well. Mm. He was very organized. He published beautiful catalogs of his artist's work. He always had a transparency ready if you needed one for a book. He kept regular hours. And there's a charming story in the book, I thought. I just realized I forgot to include it. Is it too late, Sam? About one woman who's interviewed who said she went for a job interview and she was really concerned. She had no experience in art. And she met with Castelli. And he said to her, you know, do you think you could be here by 10 in the morning? And she said, yes. He said, really? Are you sure? And she said, yes. And he said, you're hired. which gives you some sense of how galleries functioned previously. I mean, galleries were often run by artists. Someone like Betty Parsons, one of the great dealers of the 50s, was an artist herself. And they really didn't have great business skills. Castelli was so organized, and his artists benefited from that enormously. Some people fault him for being snobby, and this is an issue in the book. The author says, oh, he was so snobby, he wouldn't sell paintings to people unless they were important.
Is that true?
Well, that is an artist's fantasy. It's not a matter of being snobby, but he wanted his artist's work to go into the best collections. And that is in the interest of the artist. And he was like that. He would hold out and wait for the museum purchase instead of just selling a painting to the first person who walked in and offered him the price. So in other words, I think he was very loyal to his artists and organized about it.
Now, what about the biography itself? Annie Cohen-Salal is not someone we necessarily identify with the world of art or art dealing. How interesting and successful a biography is this?
Well, it's a bit of a mess. She's done a lot of research but hasn't really stitched the pieces of her quilt together. There's no real narrative thread. I'm sure it will be useful for future biographers. But I do think it's interesting that a French woman and a French intellectual decided to write about the American art scene. In that sense, the book is something of a reversal. I don't know that there's anything else quite like it. Previous books written by French people about the New York art scene are very hostile. One academic classic by Serge Guibeau is called How New York Stole the Idea of Modern Art. And that kind of is the definitive text about New York as perceived by the French. She has written a non-hostile book. She doesn't think we stole the idea of the art capital from the French. She thinks we really earned it through artistic achievement. So she feels generously inclined towards New York, but unfortunately, I think she just sort of lacks familiarity to give us the kind of intricate glimpse we really want. There are a lot of spelling errors in the book, and I'm wondering, do you hold the writer responsible for that, or do you hold the publisher responsible for that?
Well, in theory, everything goes back to the author. The buck stops with the author. On the other hand, a translated book, you'd think particular care would be taken.
Yeah, I couldn't understand that. Like Patterson Sims, a very well-known male curator, is identified as a woman.
So that's more than a spelling error. That's a real failure of knowledge or understanding of the...
Right. But still, it's pretty easy to fact check. Mm. Is the name Patterson? Doesn't strike me as female, is it?
Well, we know book publishers don't fact check.
Right. And this book, I think, is an unfortunate consequence of that. It's riddled with errors and... there are way too many exclamation points. Also, I think the book is probably the first biography I've read that suffers from the perils of too many research assistants.
You said as many as 23?
She thanks 23 in her acknowledgments. Too many cooks spoiled broth. Somebody has to be in charge. It's not group therapy when you write a biography. You want somebody with some vision of a person's life. And I think that's what's missing from this book.
Thanks a lot, Deborah.
Okay, thank you.
That's Deborah Solomon, who this week reviews Leo and His Circle, The Life of Leo Castelli by Annie Cohen-Salau. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, no surprise, Stieg Larsson enters the fiction list at number one with his eagerly awaited final installment of his trilogy, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. Number one with a bullet. We'll see how long it can hang on.
And it's posthumous, right?
It's been posthumous, long gone. All of them are posthumous. Mm. Rumors of a fourth to come. We'll see if that happens.
What about nonfiction?
A lot of musical chairs over here. Laura Bush still at number one with her memoir, Spoken from the Heart. It's a lot of staying power. It's her fourth week. Newt Gingrich moves up from number five. He's at number two with his Jeremiah to Save America, an expose of Barack Obama's nefarious policies and background. Manchurian President, a book very much in the same vein by Aaron Klein, moves up to number 10. It was on the extended list last week, so I think these anti-Obama books are not going out of style. And then Daniel Okrent, former public editor of the New York Times.
Editor number one.
Yes, enters at number 13 with Last Call, his history of prohibition. Another kind of interesting thing I noticed this week is there are a lot of books about war, starting with Sebastian Younger's book called War about Afghanistan. It falls to number five. Nathaniel Philbrick's Last Stand about Custer, Sitting Bull, and the Battle of Little Bighorn, it's at number eight. And Ben McIntyre's Operation Mincemeat, it's been on the list for a couple of weeks now. I believe this is its third week. It's at number 14, well-reviewed in our pages and in other pages. It's about a British ruse that, you know, used a corpse to fool the Nazis about the invasion of Sicily. Kind of a great, juicy story told very well. And Hugh Ambrose's book, The Pacific, a companion volume to the HBO miniseries, is still hanging on at number 16.
Wars of all kind, cultural and otherwise. Thank you, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Join us again next week on Inside the New York Times Book Review. Remember, there's more at our website, nytimes.com/books. For the New York Times, this is Sam Tannenhaus.